design. Today, experts say nothing must be taken for granted because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
South Korea is hosting the P4G Seoul Summit on Climate Change, bringing together leaders from more than 60 countries. Held both offline and online, the meeting sought, quote, inclusive green recovery toward carbon neutrality. South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged more international aid.
We will provide more assistance to developing countries to lay tailored green growth policies. Countries have their own stages of economic development and thus they also differ on the dependence on coal power. Certainly more assistance is needed to transition into a low carbon economy.
Outside, critics point out that South Korea continues constructing and exporting coal-fired power plants, which generate the most CO2 emissions of all fossil fuels globally, about 30%. South Korea's pledge to end coal power financing. Climate change scientists agree that the COVID-19 pandemic and its lockdowns reduced human activity, which caused a reduction in CO2 emissions. But that reduction in climate-changing pollution will be short-lived as people drive back to work, factories reopen, and airlines resume their pre-pandemic flight schedules. As the forum took place, environmental activists marched to the venue, critical of the government's carbon record and a new green growth plan to cut down old growth forest to replant young carbon-absorbing trees.
The P4G summit talks about solidarity for green growth, but the climate crisis talks that count on growth are wrong from the start. The current climate crisis is the result of infinite growth for the nation and capital, for power and greed. Even if you put green in front of growth, that's just whitewashing the truth.
P4G Partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals links with the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which focus on 17 international crises. Urgent action on climate change is number 13. Frank Smith, Seoul.
To work in Afghanistan as a journalist, one needs to be ready for facing horrifying scenarios. From being taken as hostage by the terrorist groups or powerful local commanders to becoming a victim of a blast. It was 4 years ago, on May 31st, that a massive bomb explosion killed or wounded over 600 individuals, mostly civilians. Among the victims was Habibullah Hussein Zadeh, Press TV's cameraman in Kabul.
4 years ago, during the holy month of Ramadan, a major Daesh bomb blast hit the green zone of Kabul. Habib was on his way to the office. Unfortunately, he was killed as he was close to the blast site. We found his dead body in a hospital 6 days later.
The death of Habib was not the first tragic incident for Press TV staff in Kabul. Prior to losing Habib, Press TV Bureau in Kabul had already lost Saeed Farhad Taqaddusi, another cameraman who lost his life after a rocket hit Press TV's office during a complex Taliban attack back in 2011. Saeed Mohsin Husseini remembers how all of his colleagues were shocked when a rocket hit their office in Kabul's heavily protected area.
It was in October 2011 when the Taliban launched a coordinated attack in the heavily protected area of Kabul. One of their rockets hit our office. We lost our brave cameraman, Sayed Farhad. We are committed to following the footsteps of our martyrs.
Let's not forget that the media groups in Afghanistan are facing many challenges, from the shortage of financial resources to security threats that have forced over 300 journalists and media staff to either quit their jobs or leave the country. Based on official figures, over 133 journalists and media workers in Afghanistan have been killed and many others have been wounded over the past 15 months. According to the 2021 World Press Freedom Index, released by Reporters Without Borders, Afghanistan is still considered one of the most dangerous countries for journalists and reporters around the world. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
In a rare move, Iran's oil ministry has delegated a major oil project to local companies with the aim to boost crude oil production, as U.S. sanctions still cast their shadows on the country's petroleum sector. Worth $1.3 billion, the development project aims to boost the output in the Azadegan oil field to 320,000 barrels per day, up from the existing 140,000 BPDs.
We're running our oil industry amid the U.S. sanctions that seek to destroy the strategic sector. We're not allowed to import a single oil pipe. This is why we have made the greatest achievements during this difficult period. We continue to develop our oil fields to increase our output. We have done it before and we will do it now.
Azadegan oil field is located in southwest Iran and is in the vicinity of Iraq-Iran border. Its in-place oil capacity is estimated to be around 33 billion barrels, but with the current pace, only 1.5 billion barrels are recoverable. In 2009, China's oil giant CNPC won a $2.5 billion deal with Iran's oil ministry to expedite the recovery rate in the oil field. But in 2014, Iran revoked the deal due to China's foot dragging in fulfilling the project. Local firms say the move to handle such a mega project domestically is unprecedented in the history of the oil industry in Iran. In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in 2018. Iran's oil output almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels per day, down from 2.5 million prior to the U.S.'s pullout from the nuclear deal. Now, the signing of these contracts is in line with plans to double oil production to 4.5 billion barrels a day in the next year.
As U.S. oil embargoes are still haunting Iran's crude, Tehran is resorting to domestic firms to keep the strategic sector up and running. Given the vast oil reserves waiting to be tapped into in the Azadegan oil field, experts say the development of the key reservoir means a significant boost to Iran's oil production and a strong comeback to the global market. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A tsunami of voices rising across the globe in condemnation of Israeli war crimes continued to be heard as Palestinians and their supporters thronged the streets of D.C. Steady rain showers weren't enough to dampen the spirits of demonstrators who came from all over the U.S. and descended on the National Mall by the busload.
I came out here from San Francisco. This is how serious it is. We need sanctions for sure, 100% on Israel, because what are we, like, are we their dogs? We don't have to pay them nothing. We don't owe them nothing. All you guys are doing is paying to get kids bombed in Gaza. And this is not right. We don't support no genocide at the end of the day. Like, this is not right.
The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians and condemned it for adopting what they called apartheid policies. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For the thousands gathered out here outside the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., for the National March for Palestine, it's simply not enough that the U.S. government end support for the Israelis. They want them to go a step further and introduce measures to sanction the illegitimate apartheid regime.
Protesters also demanded the U.S. government cease its campaign of harassment and allow lawyers with the International Criminal Court to carry out their investigations of Israeli war crimes unobstructed. They also called for an end to the impunity granted to the apartheid regime by major Western powers.
No country in the world was in violation of international law more than Israel. All of us have to change this. All of us have to tell the administration it is about time to remove Israel from Gaza and from Palestine.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause.
The people of the Gaza Strip have the right not just to survive, they have the right to resist, just as Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto did.
Regardless of whether or not the Biden administration bends to the will of demonstrators, those battling for Palestinian liberation here in D.C. seem just as ready to resist Israeli aggression as their brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
COVID-1 Barakat vaccine developers say 1 million doses of the country's first homegrown vaccine have been produced, which will be delivered to the Ministry of Health. Speaking at the press conference, the managing director of COVID-1 Barakat Vaccine Research Group, Hassan Jalili, said production of the vaccine will increase to 3 million doses next month.
We have produced 1 million doses of COVID-1 Barakat vaccine and will be delivered to the health ministry, and its production will increase to 3 million doses next month. And with the launch of new production lines, the figure will increase to 18 million doses soon. Public vaccination with COVID-1 Barakat is going to start in mid-June after clinical results are confirmed by the Ministry of Health.
Officials in charge of developing COVID-1 Barakat vaccine said with the third phase of human trial of the vaccine being almost finished, the result shows E1's vaccine has effectiveness much higher than expectations and is ready for emergency use after being approved by the Health Ministry. COVID-1 Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020 and started to be mass-produced on March 29th. E1 is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population. The second Iranian coronavirus vaccine, Razi-Covpars, which started a clinical trial on February 27th, will be mass-produced in early August. E1 is also currently producing vaccines jointly with three countries of Cuba, Russia, and Australia. E1 started mass vaccination against COVID-19 with a Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine on February 9th. E1 says it will soon become one of the world's important manufacturers of the COVID-19 vaccine. COVID-1 Barakat vaccine developers are planning to get the approval of the World Health Organization for this Iranian vaccine so as to be listed as one of the safest vaccines for emergency use. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The U.S. has pledged to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan by September 11. The move will put an end to America's longest direct war in the country. The announcement of a troop withdrawal has urged some circles to discuss the consequences of the American military presence in Afghanistan over the past two decades. As they say, the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan has had adverse effects on the country on different political, economic, social, and military fronts.
When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, it said the American troops were there to build a country, establish a modern Afghanistan, bring poppy cultivation to zero, and uproot Al-Qaeda and terrorism. But now the U.S. says it does not care about such issues. Of course, it was a lie, and we know about that.
Critics of the U.S. policy in Afghanistan believe Washington's involvement in Afghan issues is not limited to its military presence. They say Washington has also created ethnic tensions among local Afghans. Under such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, as Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to first come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with foreign players in line with Afghanistan's national interests.
The U.S. military presence in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism has not only led to an increase in militancy, poverty, and drug abuse, but apart from its disruptive consequences, it has also resulted in America's longest war. Now, after several years of a struggle and hardships inflicted upon Afghanistan and its people, Afghans are welcoming Washington's decision to withdraw its forces from the country by September 11. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation. That was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib front and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia. That is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A massive public outpouring in Peshawar, the regional capital of Pakistan's northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Anger is boiling in Pakistan like elsewhere in the Muslim world over Israel's atrocities during the 11-day long conflict, which the United Nations said could amount to war crimes. Pakistanis are particularly furious over Israeli troops for desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds, Islam's third holiest site. Similar protests have also been held in major cities against Israel's plans to evict Palestinians from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds.
We have a very deep-seated love for Palestine. It is a part of our belief system to live and die for Palestine. And that is why such a huge number of people have turned up in this protest.
The ongoing protests are mounting increasing pressure on Pakistani government to help Palestinian militarily to prevent another Israeli aggression. Pakistan has backed Turkey's demand to set up an international protection mechanism to prevent Israel's aggression in future, although the scope and reach of such a mechanism have yet to be established. Analysts believe that some non-Arab countries can form a joint military coalition in not-so-distant future.
We want the government to support us. We will go to Palestine to defend our brothers. But if Israel fights with us, then we will hit back.
More mass anti-Israel protests are expected in the coming weeks and months as different opposition parties are planning demonstrations across Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
دانشگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello,
everyone, and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. A painful reminder of the dark and shameful chapter of Canadian history, and also an unthinkable loss that was spoken about but never documented. Both allude to the discovery of a mass grave on Thursday containing the remains of the 215 children at the Kamloops Indian Residential School. This, many argue, reminds one of violence inflicted by residential schools and wounds carried by communities into the present time. There's also a long list of human rights violations across Canada, including thousands of missing Indigenous women and girls. Stay tuned for a debate on that issue.
Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. The North American country has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights in the international arena. However, mounting evidence on racism and discrimination against minorities, in particular Aboriginal people, proves the contrary. Last week, the remains of more than 200 children, some as young as 3 years old, were found at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children in the province of British Columbia. The Kamloops School operated between 1890 and 1969 when the federal government took over operations from the Catholic Church and turned it into a day school until it was closed in 1978. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the discovery was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter of Canada's history. Indigenous groups also demanded a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. Vigils were also held to commemorate the victims.
It's really a tragedy for having those priests and those nuns running those schools, raping and killing and murdering and abusing those Indigenous children. And it really takes effect into all the younger generation, that intergenerational trauma.
When I heard about the 250 children who, you know, were discovered, their remains were discovered in a residential school mass graveyard, my heart was absolutely broken. And it just... I've been sort of in a grieving mode since.
Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend these schools, which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into a white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages, and many experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at residential schools, but efforts continue to try to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that the country committed cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Such a system is just the tip of the iceberg, since reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have also been murdered or gone missing in Canada in the last 30 years. Irrespective of decades of structural and systematic discrimination against Indigenous people, which have been denounced by prominent rights groups, Canada also grapples with some other serious human rights issues, including persistent exports of military equipment to countries with a record human rights violations. However, Canada has time and again blamed countries such as Iran, China, and Venezuela for violating human rights. For now, the discovery of bodies at the former boarding school has once again turned a spotlight on Canada's claim about being a human rights advocate.
Well, that was Mehdi Farman reporting there. Let me invite one of our guests to this debate. Here we'll have human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good to have you with us, Daniel. A real dark chapter in the history of Canada and the crimes committed against the country's Indigenous people. What was your reaction when you first learned about a children's mass grave?
Well, I mean, I share the feeling that it's heartbreaking, and I was horribly saddened by this, but sadly not surprised. I mean, as you mentioned, there were thousands, tens of thousands of Indigenous children taken from their families and sent to these institutions during my lifetime. And, you know, when you do that sort of thing, when you separate children from their families, and you isolate them, this sort of thing happens time and again. And sadly, and I was raised Catholic, by the way, sadly the Catholic Church has been as guilty or more guilty than anyone.
on the phone with us, we also have former editor with the Catholic New Times, Ted Schmidt, in Toronto. Ted, in 2015, a national commission said that the Ottawa government has committed cultural genocide by forcing some 150,000 Indigenous children to attend residential schools. Now, some consider the issue as collective pain and trauma for Indigenous communities in Canada. What's your take?
Well, my take this is Catholics are not fundamentally the guilty entity here. This is a governmental program. This is nothing but a settler colonial program. And the church is brought in as Canadians to be part of it. It's no different than what has gone on historically in places like Australia and South Africa. So this is just a separate colonial problem. It's terrible. But religion is not the fundamental actor here. Religion is just acting as part of the state. And that's where we have to take a look at it. I mean, in our morning paper here, they got it right. It says, Ottawa is pressed to account. Ottawa, this is the problem. Our Indigenous people are like Indigenous people everywhere. They've been shoved to the margins of countries. They've been put into the worst land. Their drinking water is terrible. It's settler colonialism. And now, I'm a Roman Catholic, and the church has been part of it. There's no doubt about it. But the church is not the fundamental actor here.
Okay.
They've done bad things, but that when Columbus landed, religion follows the flag. The flag comes first. And the flag here is the British Empire, who came to Canada, pushed First Nations people into areas that we call ghettos in some countries. And if we took a look at Israel, you push people into Gaza. Here we push people into reserves. There's the fundamental problem.
I see. Now, Daniel, for more than a century, authorities forcibly separated thousands of Indigenous children from their families and made them attend residential schools that aimed to assimilate the children into white Canadian society. So what have been the ramifications of such practices?
Well, I agree that this is a genocidal project, and I don't think you have to qualify it as cultural genocide. It's just genocide. If you look at the Genocide Convention in 1948, it talks about a genocidal act. One genocidal act is transferring children from their parents forcibly because of their ethnicity or race. That's exactly what happened here. It's just genocide, plain and simple. It happened in Canada. It happened in the United States. It happened throughout Latin America. And it is deplorable, and it keeps happening. Let's not forget there are still thousands of Indigenous women who have been disappeared in Canada and have yet to be found.
That's true.
Trudeau promised he would do something about that upon being elected, and he's done nothing. So this genocide continues.
Ted, as you know, residential schools were run by churches, as also you just mentioned, until 1996. They were rife with physical, mental, and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence, causing intergenerational trauma for Indigenous population across Canada. Now, what can heal this old wound?
Talking to me?
Yes, go ahead, Ted.
What can heal this wound? Well, it's not totally genocide, because First Nations are here. They're recovering, much like Palestinians. Yes, it's been a slow and incremental genocide, but it's not totally genocide. First Nations in Canada are being educated, not as widely as they should be, but it takes a long time to respond to cultural genocide. There's no doubt about it. But there has been a wonderful advances with our First Nations people. But they're still struggling. I mean, you just don't respond to this overnight. So we have a truth and reconciliation, but we still have poor water on our First Nations reserve. We've had First Nations poison in the north of Ontario. But it's not total genocide. It's been a slow, incremental genocide, as it has happened in Palestine as well.
Now, Daniel, what are the underlying reasons for this legacy of Canadian colonialism to persist at this date?
Well, I mean, because, as my colleague mentioned, Canada and the United States are settler colonial countries. They were founded on land where people already lived, indigenous people already lived. And so a big part of the project of both of these countries was to remove huge swaths of these peoples from their land. And if they didn't go quietly, they were killed. And that is genocide. Can I just, again, remind people, go look at the 1948 Genocide Convention. You don't have to destroy a people in their entirety for it to be genocide. The Genocide Convention makes it clear, in whole or in part, you are destroying them. This is genocide. It's not kind of genocide. It's not cultural genocide. It's genocide. And we have to call it as such, because that has a meaning. If a country engages in genocide, that triggers certain obligations upon the United Nations to act, and they should act, to protect these people, to get these people the basic necessities they need, and to protect them from these states that continue to carry out genocide against them.
Now let's take a look at a bigger picture of the issues of TED. Canada has oftentimes appeared as defender of human rights and a vocal advocate for a pluralistic society that respects rights of immigrants and minorities, yet you still witness wide-ranging abuses against indigenous people and confinement of immigration detainees in jails and you name it. Why is that?
Well, it still continues. There's no doubt about it. It's highly embarrassing to Canadians who pride ourselves on the rule of law. But we have a prime minister here who will not act on totally. He uses language, but he continues to support genocide here, but also continues not to do much about Palestinian rights. Our record there at the United Nations is very poor. It's a long time. There's a lot of power that the state has that it hasn't totally come up with total answers. We've had truth and reconciliation, but this isn't changed overnight. Canadians are very embarrassed by this. It hurts our national reputation as the people who care, who people want to live next to and observe international laws. So we haven't totally lived up to our international commission here and international rights, and we haven't lived up to it in Palestine either. This is exactly what our guest is saying there. You're just part of a separate colonial project. Canada was working hand in hand with Great Britain, shoving people into reserves, stealing their land. We've done this. They did this in South Africa. They did this to Aborigines in Australia. And they're still reeling with high rates of incarceration, drunkenness, etc. But even in Australia, there's improvement. And in Canada, as I said, we've had many First Nations. They deserve incredible credit for surviving this. They're getting educated. We have outstanding lawyers, doctors, professional people. But it's a long-term project. Settler colonialism doesn't disappear in a day.
Daniel, there are also serious human rights issues relating to overseas operations of Canadian extractive companies and also nonstop exports of military hardware to countries with records of human rights violations. So let's have your comment on that, and how much longer will this go on?
I mean, it's going to go on as long as the Canadian people and the United States citizens put up with it. I mean, this is our tax dollars at work. We are invading and destroying countries throughout the earth. This is not only a genocidal project, it's a nihilist project. We're destroying cultures, ancient antiquities. I just got back from saw that happening very close up. The West is on a crusade against culture and against peoples throughout the world. And if it's going to end, it's going to be because the people living in those countries who have at least some say over their government say, it's enough. Stop.
Ted, let me name a number of other issues that Canada has been grappling with. We have violence against Indigenous women, immigration detention, solitary confinement, corporate accountability, religious freedom, and disability rights. They're also among some other issues. Now, how can a country with such a record blame others for rights violations?
We can't. It's as simple as that. I don't think the answer, particularly in the United States, if you take a look at the United States in terms of Palestine, that's where the power lies. Now, in Canada, we have a little more opportunity to deal with these issues. But as I said, it's a long term. The tremendous response here to these graves, it goes right across the country. And people are very upset about it, but as I said, it's not going to go away overnight. We're going to have to press our governments to do a better job. I mean, when you look, we can't even give First Nations people drinking water. We can't solve this problem just yet. We keep making promises, and so the pressure has to be kept on by the majority of Canadians who care a lot about our international reputation. But it's a long-term project. We're working on it, and what can you say? Nothing gets solved overnight here.
Okay, let me ask Daniel. Daniel, Ted is saying that these issues cannot disappear and be handled overnight. So how much time is needed for anybody, Trudeau or anybody else in the future, to address such issues in Canada?
Well, it's already been a long night, hasn't it? It's been centuries. It's been a night that's lasted for centuries. I think it has to be tackled immediately. The time is run out for excuses. I think a lot of resources could be put towards First Nations peoples, again, throughout North America, very quickly, if there was the political will to do so, to help these people not just survive but thrive and to rebuild their cultures. I agree with my colleague that it's a miracle that these First Nation peoples are still alive, that they have survived, and they have done it on their own. But it's time that resources, real resources, are diverted from war and given to these people.
Okay. And Ted, one last question. What's your prescription for Canada to tackle such woes?
Well, my colleague is exactly right. We're on the cusp of spending $29 billion for airplanes. Now, that has to be diverted away from war and to get very serious about our First Nations. And I would think that we're doing not a bad job of making sure that First Nations have free education and housing, et cetera, et cetera. But it's going to take time. But I think the goodness of the Canadian people are demanding this. We have parliamentarians who are taking this seriously. But we have to put the pressure on the PM, who talks a very good game and comes across globally as a very progressive person. But when we can't give people drinking water yet on our reserves, there's something wrong. So, you know, I've got confidence that as a people, we're good people, but things move slowly. Pressure is the only answer.
Okay. Let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and also former editor of the Catholic New Times, Ted Schmidt in Toronto, on the phone with their comments and contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Around 1,700 Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine have been arrested since the Israeli regime launched law and order in May, says Mustafa Abu Sneh, reporter, in an article titled, Israeli regime detains more Palestinian citizens as arrest campaign enters second week. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime police arrested more than six Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine, the latest roundup in a campaign that has seen 1,700 Palestinians picked up since early May, according to a committee monitoring the situation. Six people were arrested in Kafr Qana, a Palestinian town in the occupied Palestine north, while an as yet unknown number of Palestinians were taken into custody in northern towns of Arara and Arar, according to local media. Video footage circulated on social media showed the Zionist regime military police attacking Palestinians in Arara. Middle East Eye could not independently confirm the footage location and date. The arrests are part of the Zionist regime police mass arrest campaign called Law and Order, which began on May 24th after 2 weeks of protests in mixed cities against the Zionist regime settlement policies in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. The Arab Emergency Committee, which was formed in the wake of the protest in early May, said it has documented that in addition to the arrest of 1,700 Palestinians who reside in occupied Palestine, there have been 300 related cases of assault. Around 100 Palestinian citizens of occupied Palestine have been arrested daily since the campaign began, the committee said, and some of them were released later. The police launched the campaign after concluding that their power of deterrence had been severely damaged among the Palestinian community inside the occupied Palestine after confrontations in mixed cities including Lod, known as Lead to Palestinians, Acre, and Haifa. The Zionist regime police and media reports indicated that the crackdown, an attempt to reimpose deterrence, would last for 48 hours. It has instead continued over the past week. Several political leaders and activists have been swept up in the campaign and now face trials, including Kamal al-Khatib, vice president of the Islamic Movement in the occupied Palestine, and a member of the Arab Follow-up Committee, who has been charged for incitement to so-called terrorism. Recently, a Zionist regime court extended the detention of two friends of Mohammad Kewan, a Palestinian from the northern town of Umm al-Fahm, who was shot by the Zionist regime police on May 12 and later succumbed to his wounds in a hospital in Haifa. The Zionist regime police accused Kewan's friends of attempting a car ramming operation near the junction of the Zionist town May Ami, about 2 kilometers from Umm al-Fahm. The lawyer for the two friends said the trial was political, according to local news site Arab 48. He asked the Zionist regime police to present the court with video footage from the May Ami junction. The police replied that cameras were not working at that time. Kewan was the second Palestinian citizen of the occupied Palestine to have been killed in May. In Lod, Musa Hasuna was also killed during a confrontation with far-right Israelis backed by settlers from the occupied West Bank. Human rights groups have condemned the mass arrest campaign of the occupied Palestine population of Palestinian citizens, that is about 1.9 million Palestinians, who descend from those who avoided the mass expulsion of Palestinians during the creation of the fake regime of Israel in 1948 and comprise one-fifth of this land's population. Recently, War on Want, lawyers for Palestinian human rights, and Amnesty International sent a letter to UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, urging the British government to investigate patterns of serious violations and abuse by Israeli authorities, with particular attention to the right to life and the prohibition on torture and ill treatment under international human rights law. The rights group said that they have monitored various violations committed by Israeli regime authorities inside the occupied Palestine, the West Bank, and East Al-Quds. These violations include the Zionist regime's use of excessive force, arbitrary arrest of lawyers and human rights observers, arrest and detention of minors, and the blatant support of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu encouraging Israeli regime authorities to use an iron fist in the repression of protests, the letter said.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.